Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, dig it. Stop right on.
Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Hey, good morning. Connor, how you doing, young man? I can't hear you.
I said I'm doing all right. How about yourself?
I'm doing fine, man. It's always good to see you.
Yeah, same here.
And I want to say, before we get started, I got a couple great guests lined up for the entire show. And I want to begin with welcoming my first guest, Ms. Tamu Kenyama. Good morning to you, dear sister. How are you?
I'm great, thank you, and thank you for having me on.
Is the pronunciation of your name correct?
Absolutely.
It is wonderful. We have a mutual friend, Brother Tony Courtney, who I owe a debt of gratitude to. I am probably as aware of things as I am because as a young man, I had the pleasure of sitting down and drinking at the foot of Brother Tony Courtney.
Great, great, good people.
Yeah, so let's do this. Let's begin by who is Tamu Kenyama?
Well, Tamu wears many hats. Wife, mother, grandmother, community warrior, educator.
You know, you are here to talk about an episode that occurred in your life, half a century ago, and when you and I both were very young people. And, looking at this life through rose-colored glasses from the standpoint that we didn't like what we saw, and we thought we'd be able to change the world. Did you, I've got a young producer here who's 20 years old, and I talked about this the other day with him. He has the whole world before him, and when I was his age, I really thought I was going to change the world.
Right.
As you get older and grayer and wiser, that old axiom, wisdom is wasted on the young. Youth is wasted on the young.
But
that's what, idealism is, and the fact that there was a battle that had to be fought. Let's talk a little bit about a book that you have written, 1148 Lewis Street. Let's first begin by going back to those 60s and the turbulent 60s and what was going on that a young person like you and those you were with were uneasy. What was the society like for black people?
It was very oppressive. And as a young person, we saw that things were not in our favor on almost any level. As we were more exposed to what was going on, not just in our communities, but in the whole society and the world, we saw that our people, were not getting what we should get, or what we thought we should get. And so, we began to work toward trying to create a better life and better conditions for our people, which led me to, as a matter of fact, even in school, in college, I did attend UWM, and that was a very good jumping point for us because the Black Studies program at that time was very, very thorough and took us back further than than some of us had studied before as growing up in the public schools. You know, we didn't get that much information about our people and our culture. So that took us way back to pre-colonial time, pre-slavery, and pre-all of that. So, you know, that learning more and more about ourselves and our people just was motivating for us to see that there was a better way and a better life for us ahead. But we were going to have to be the ones to do it. Nobody else is going to do it for us.
You know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that led us to being involved with different organizations in the community.
You know, I'm a born and bred Milwaukeean, and so I remember, too, as a very young man, a young boy, just how oppressive Milwaukee was and the fact that we were so segregated. And it was at a time when there was pushback, and our generation was one that was not going to be as acceptable or accommodating as the one before us. And the movement was live and ripe, and the energy was just unmatched. And it was a time in history that I don't even think we even understood the magnitude of what we were actually involved in.
Right. And it wasn't just our community that was fighting against the status quo. Other communities as well. There was just, you know, upheaval everywhere, you know, on college campuses, and, you know, people dropping out of society, doing their own thing. So, because things were, the status quo was just horrible at that time. And for us, for people in our age group, you know, we could see that there was, things were not as they should be. And as I said, people dropping out of society, being flower children, hippies, and in that community. And then, and in our community, we were, you know, having issues on campuses as well. And as I said, the more we were exposed, the more we desired and were inspired to move, to try and move heaven and earth to get better conditions for ourselves and our people.
You know, one of the things that I will never forget is that there was this divide in between us, and it was whether or not you were going to follow Dr. King or whether or not you're going to follow Malcolm X. And the movement, and you know, so how did you, what made you make the decision to follow the more aggressive African centric side of things as opposed to Dr. King?
Well, again, exposure makes the difference. There were things like with Dr. King, you know, we respected him, and we felt that our struggle needed to be addressed on every level, and that was the level that he chose. But it just wasn't for people of my mindset. And when being exposed to the other side, following Malcolm, basically, was just more appealing to us. And then the other thing is that a lot of people didn't realize is that it really wasn't that big of a difference between the two. And then at a point, they began to be closer connected in their outlook on what needed to happen. It really wasn't as far as apart as the media and everybody else in this, you know, make it seem as though they were just totally, totally opposite, but they were not totally opposite.
So let's talk about the Republic of New Africa and mm-hmm. and what that organization was and what enamored you to become a member of the Republic of New Africa?
again, you know, being exposed, I had never heard of ideas like reparations. I had never heard about the possibility of us as a people in this hemisphere separating and having our own government. So when I was exposed to that, I'm like, wow, it was just, it was overwhelming for me, and I was hooked. It was just like a rebirth, and I jumped in with all I had in supporting the idea of separation and independence. And, of course, reparations, et cetera.
Well, you know, the reason that you are a guest today is because you're back in Milwaukee. To talk about a book that you've written and 1148 Lewis Street. Let's talk about what that is.
Okay, first of all, let me explain the title. The title, 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey, came from the incident that happened 51 years ago in Mississippi, where the Republic of New Africa had two headquarters, two government centers, I'm sorry. One was the main headquarters, and the other one was more where citizens of the Republic worked and went out and worked the community, talking about RNA, Republic of Africa. And, of course, we were not welcome in Mississippi. You know, you think about 51 years ago, they definitely were not welcoming us coming in, talking about black power, etc. So, anyway, there was a shooting incident. We were at the house.
So hold on a second. Mm-hmm. We've got to go to a break. My guest is Tamu Kenyama. She is the author of 1148 Lewis Street. We've got to go to a break. Our phone lines are open as always at 844-967-2789. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back. The Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guest is Tamu Kenyama. She is the author of 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey. So first, how did you wind up down in Mississippi?
We were actually just visiting, because my husband and I lived here in Milwaukee, and we were going down. We went down to visit the some of the other brothers and sisters from the Republic of New Africa. My husband was actually the first vice president. There were four vice presidents, you know, for the various regions, and so. You know, from time to time, you know, he would get together with Brother Imari Obadeli, who was the president, and, you know, some of the other officials. So we went down to visit, just checking things out, and not planning to stay very long. But the second day that we were there, that morning is when we, you know, woke up to gunfire and tear gas.
So clearly, that's at this time in history, the FBI, the CIA, were without question, covertly looking into organizations like yours and basically following everything that you guys did. Why would they attack you? I mean, what were they after you for?
First of all, they attacked because, like you say, they were scrutinizing all groups, any group that they felt uncomfortable with. Martin Luther King was as well,
right,
was being observed.
Was the organization charged with sedition?
No, not at that time. It was after the shooting incident, because no one had done anything. We had not done anything, you know, broken any law, had not committed any crime. And a matter of fact, nobody in the house was wanted for anything. But their excuse that was used by the police and FBI was that they were trying to serve a warrant on a brother who at one time was participating with us, with the RNA. That brother lived in Milwaukee, but they knew his whereabouts. They knew when he went to Mississippi. They knew when he traveled there. They knew how long he'd been there, et cetera, et cetera. And as a matter of fact, the brother had, I don't know what went down, but he had been expelled from the center, from the government center, because you had to have a certain character to participate. And whatever he had done was, he was expelled. And so the FBI and police knew this because they had their private spy who had joined the Republic of New Africa here in Milwaukee while we were all here. And so he was telling them each and every move that
right.
was made. So they had plenty of time. That's what my point is, that they had plenty of time to arrest him and give him a warrant if they wanted to. Because, I mean, he was freely walking the streets. I don't know where he was living, but no longer living at that location. But that was the excuse that they gave for coming that morning.
So those, your organization, as well as others, at that point in time, were armed. Is it safe to say mm-hmm. that you guys were armed?
Absolutely.
Okay. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, we didn't go there looking for any trouble and inviting any trouble, but we did believe in
self-defense.
Self-defense, yes.
Okay, so now, this particular morning, did they knock on the door or they just began to mm-hmm. attack you?
No, they didn't knock on the door, but they went on a bullhorn and told us to get out of the house. And they gave us a minute and 15 seconds, understanding that everybody was asleep, sound asleep. But we had a minute and 15 seconds to get up and try and throw some clothes on and get out of the house. And that didn't happen. We weren't able to get out in a minute and 15 seconds. So the tear gas canisters and bullets began to fly all, you know, just coming into the house, you know, and plaster falling, windows breaking. It was, you know, like a horror movie. And then there was an exchange of gunfire.
So this clearly was a federal assault. It wasn't local police from Mississippi.
It was both local and federal.
Okay. So they began this assault. How many people were in the house?
Seven people. There were two sisters and five brothers.
How was everybody armed?
No.
So
no, I don't even know how many weapons were in the house, but
right.
There was a brother, a young brother, who also lived in Milwaukee at some point in his life. But anyway, he grabbed myself and the other sister and took us to safety and, you know, got us out of the way of the gunfire because they had pre-planned for if any attacks, because the, you know, were subject to be attacked by the Klan and other hate groups. So they were prepared for that. And he took us to a tunnel. And then after, I guess, a short time, the other brothers came down in the tunnel and then eventually saw that it was law enforcement officers. So, and at that point, we, you know.
Okay, so initially you didn't know who the assault was from.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got to go to a break. Can you hang on?
Okay. Sure.
All right. Connor, are we going to a break? We got a minute or what?
We got about a minute left.
Okay, we got about a minute left. So the reason I'm asking these questions is we've got to paint the picture of what was actually going on, this assault that happened, and the fact that they clearly were looking for somebody. Not making excuses for anything they did, but pointing out a picture or painting a picture of just what took place. Got to go to a break. My guest is Ms. Tamu Kenyama. She is the author of 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey. You're tuned in to the Earl Ingram Show. You can join us at 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
Until you use me up, until you use me up.
And but anyway, they continued to do that until the van came, and then I don't know how long they stayed there, but the other people took us downtown and paraded us through the streets in chains. Which is very reminiscent of how our people were paraded through the streets in chains during the enslavement period. But anyway, so we were arrested. Now, there was another house. As I said before, there were two government centers, and they went to the other house simultaneously when they were at our house, the house that I was in. The other house was
did you say two centers?
Two government centers. Well, they were houses, but we called them government centers.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So the other one was like the headquarters, which was right near Jackson State College. And
but now you use the term headquarters. There were different.
Yeah.
You guys were spread over the country. Were these the major headquarters?
This was major. The major.
So the Republic of New Africa was centered in out of Mississippi.
It didn't start there. Some members from the north, the citizens from the north, moved there to start building on what we were,
okay,
you know, trying to do. As a matter of fact, there had been land. We had tried to purchase a large amount of land, and to just, even though we know, you know, we realize that, you know, a government is not built on land like that that you purchase, but that was like a starting point.
So is it safe to say then that you guys were looking to, similar to the Nation of Islam, building a government inside of the government?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And that's what we call it. We don't call it an organization. We call it a government, the provisional government, the provisional government of the Republic of New Africa.
Okay.
Okay. So. But before the shootout, we had purchased land, but then we're in the process of purchasing land from a brother, and he was harassed so much or threatened and et cetera that he dropped the deal, and we were not able to complete that.
So purchase. Before I took you off track, you were talking about the second building.
Mm-hmm. Right. The second one, that's where Brother Imari, the president, President Brother Imari, and three other individuals were in that house. Well, they were, you know, up, dressed and working, doing government business. And when the police and FBI got there to that spot. And so when they yelled at them on the bullhorn, well, they immediately were able to come out because they were already up and dressed, and asked them, what's the problem? You know, what can I do for you, et cetera? And nothing happened at that house. Absolutely nothing happened at that house. It was just a conversation, and they were arrested and charged with everything that the seven of us in the other house was charged with.
So I have to tell you, understanding that time, myself, the fact that three officers were, two were wounded, one was killed, it's amazing to me that you guys weren't all killed yourselves.
Exactly. You're absolutely
so,
right.
So what do you attribute that to? And especially in Mississippi.
I think it was because it was so many eyes on them at that time. But this did not just make national news, it made international news. And we were also connected or in contact with other countries that supported what we were doing. Berthe Imari was pretty much a political scientist. There were several people who in the group who had done their homework and had also been involved in touch with international law, trying to get support, if you will, from the international law, because any people that's been enslaved and all that, you know, we're due certain things that our people were never offered, and never, and even when we're asked for it many years ago, never got it. So we were in the process of doing those kind of things. It wasn't just a bunch of young people who decided to run off and try to get some land. It wasn't like that. They had truly done their homework. It was over 150 people who had come together back in Detroit to at a convention that pulled this whole the idea and the whole thing together, and decided on that we were a separate and independent people, not independent, but a separate people, and that we deserved a nation, anything that any other nation of people deserved. So
let's fast forward to now. You guys apprehended, the charges, mm-hmm. first degree murder. I mean, an officer is dead.
Everything you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. So how? What happened from that point? Because, you know, you just don't allow people to walk away from murdering from what they call murdering a police officer.
Absolutely.
Even to this day, you know, that's
right.
You're going to pay an ultimate price for that. So
that's
let's move forward to the charging and the time that people.
The four. The brothers, it was five brothers in that house. Four of them were charged with murder. All of us were charged with conspiracy, treason, you name it. We were charged with it. And I was saying that the other people were charged with everything that we were, because at first everybody was charged with everything. But as time went on and we going to the hearings and all that, you know, the people in the second house that I talked about, most of them, their charges were either
dropped.
Dropped, except for Imari, because their intentions was to keep him, and they put other stuff on him, but they couldn't do the murder charge on him because he was not in the house. But as time went on, they were all, those brothers were the ones that got the major sentencing. The sister from the was in the other house in the where no shooting took place, she was the first person to be released after a couple of months. Then the sister that was in the house with me, with us, she was pregnant, and they were able to get her out based on her condition, because she needed.
So you guys, very young, the criminal defense attorneys for murder, Really, really expensive. And when you're talking about all of you, you had resources like that, huh?
Well, one of the persons,
I know that there weren't a whole lot of people who were going to take that pro bono.
But they did. There was a group of lawyers, Brother Chokwe Lumumba, who later became mayor of Jackson, he was a college student at the time, a law student, but he was able to gather a group of lawyers. Well, he went to the main person, lawyer, John Britton, who put together a group of black lawyers who came to our defense immediately, and they were just brilliant. They were just brilliant, and the way they orchestrated as much as they could, you know, how things were running, you know, the things that they would use, and in the courts, it was just masterful.
So I would think that many of these attorneys came from different parts of the nation.
Nope.
No, they were all in Mississippi.
Yes,
all right.
They were all young black lawyers, several of them, and. What they did with the strategy that they used to keep my husband and the other three brothers from getting the death penalty, because that was definitely on the table. The way they did that, they orchestrated, well, in selecting the jury, they knew they were going to get a conviction, the brothers were going to be convicted. That was no question. But trying to save their lives is what they were after. And they did that through the selection of jurors.
So let me do this. We've got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. My guest is Tamu Kanyama, and she is the author of 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. My guest is Tamu Kanyama. She is the author of 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey, and she's in Milwaukee, to talk about the book. And let's go to the phone lines quickly. Let's go to Gary. Can we go to the phones? Okay, Gary, go ahead. Good morning.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I turned my radio on, and I can never get you guys. It's always static. Do you know when it's going to be fixed?
Well,
where are you at right
going
now?
Going on for like...
Yeah. Well, there's some work being done, so just bear with us. We know it's out, but there's some work being done on it as we speak.
Okay, so I can hear you. The only way I can hear you, I didn't even know what you're talking about. So
okay.
I apologize for that. Bro.
That's all right.
I really do.
Well, thanks for letting us know, man. They're working on
okay,
it. We're aware
you.
Of it. Thank you. All right.
Okay, bye.
All right. So let's expedite.
For Devil Radio.
All right, so let's expedite it. So you guys were arrested. Some were charged. How much jail time was done?
The brothers got life, and they got from the state. They got life, and then 15 years from federal.
Life plus 15 years.
Yes.
So is it safe to say some are still incarcerated?
No, that was a fluke how they were able to get out based on an error on the part of the state of Mississippi. They had served 8 years, I guess. the state of Mississippi, the prison had to was up for had to depopulate because it was overcrowded, and they were under federal investigation for all of that. So they ended up sending people, everybody who had time to do in other jurisdictions, they sent them there. Well, when they sent the brothers to the various prisons in, well, some of them came here to Atlanta, and others, the other two were someplace else. But anyway, they sent them to federal prison. And the very next day, somebody had pulled their coat and let them know that that was a mistake, because they would lose jurisdiction if they sent them away. So they got them back the very next day. However, our attorneys worked really hard for the next couple years trying to show that they had lost jurisdiction when they crossed the state line and turned them over to federal. And well, we eventually won after like I said, after a couple years, we did win that case.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And so all of the time that they had from the day that they were sent back to federal prison, they had to send them back to federal prison, and for a period of time. So all of the time that they had spent in prison, in federal custody, from the very first day when they were depopulating, all of that time, and the time that they came back and spent in Mississippi and then back to federal, all of that time counted as federal time, and therefore they had done a third of those 15 years, and they were able to be released. And that was just based on a technicality.
So let me ask you, did that impact, surely that impacted and affected what those men and others were able to do with their lives, having that kind of history associated with them? Were they able to move on with their lives? How long did it take?
Well, they went on with their lives. I know the two that were my husband and another brother Faga, who was both. They were more connected because they were the two that were sent here. I'm to Atlanta and back and forth and all that. I do know that the third brother, he continued on with. I think all of them continued on in some type of revolutionary activities. All of them did.
Yeah. Well, you know, as life went on, the revolutionary activities that you guys were doing at a young age fell by the wayside, and they became just like anybody else, just trying to raise a family. And
that
happened, right?
No, not exactly.
Okay.
While my husband was incarcerated, he developed something called the blueprint for the African Community Centers for Unity and Self-Determination. And it's basically, to make it short, is like a scientific effort to bring about unity with our people. What we try and do is bring together organizations, individuals, and organizations, because we're all working and not reinventing the wheel. But so you stay in your organization, everybody's keep doing what they're doing, that's doing something positive. But you know, we come together on one accord in terms of the ideology that we need to be free. It takes a minute to go into details. But anyway, he started working on that. And when he came home back here to Milwaukee, he tried to, you know, put it out there, you know, and start it. It didn't take hold. When we moved to Atlanta, he tried it, and then by 2003, I think it was January 2003, he brought the family together and said, we're going to do this, and we did it. And it was very strong for many years, But it, these last couple of years, it's taken a nosedive. But, you know, there's still certain remnants of it that's still effective. Right now, what's still the thing that's still moving is the that was born out of the African Community Centers is the Elder Council, which is a it's kind of like an entity of, in and of itself. And, you know, it takes a minute to explain all that. So but the Elder Council, what we have done is solve certain problems in our community that, because, you know, instead of going to the courts, you know, we the parties have to agree to abide by, you know, whatever results the
So let's do this because we're running out of time. You're going to be at two locations this weekend. Let's talk about where you're going to be.
I'm going to be at on Friday, July 16th. I'll be at July 15th, Friday. I'll be at Wisconsin Black Historical Society, and that's at 2620 West Center Street. And that's from 5:30 till 7:30. And then on Saturday, July 16th, I'll be at Coffee Makes You Black. And that's at 2803 North Titonia Avenue. And that's from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m.
And clearly you'll be signing books and
yes.
having books for sale.
Yes, yes.
And speaking, I would clearly think
exactly.
that would be a part of it too.
Yes.
Well, so
yes.
how
and answering questions, you know, that anybody may have about the incident and everything else.
So, how often have you made it back to Milwaukee? I mean, is this you know during that period of time? You know, since that period of time.
A lot, because you know I have family here, so
yeah.
you know I come back. Pretty often, you know.
You know, your sojourn sounds so much like the move in Philadelphia
yeah.
movement and what took place there. And and so, you know, it's history. It's our history. Young people need to be made aware of it. It's not just, you know, the elders or the seniors, they need to know the fight that people put up to try to force
yeah.
a nation that has been wrong
yeah.
all along to attempt to do things that are right. And so it's an honor to have had you on these airwaves. I'm going to show up at probably a couple of those places, get a chance to meet you and listen
to
you.
That would be wonderful. That would be great.
I will definitely do that. I will be there. There's no question about it. Thank you very much for telling your story. I personally will see you Friday and probably Saturday too.
Okay.
We thank Brother Tony Courtney for connecting us.
Absolutely.
And we've got to go to a break. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Really
right.
appreciate
Thank
it. You've been tuned in this first hour to the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back.
For all of these things, so much more.